Hello, welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore, and I'm with Daniel Freib. Hi, Rich. Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Okay, lots to talk about today. We're going to have to try and squeeze it into as short a time as possible. But first of all, where are we, Lionel?
We are in the judges' court at Brown's in St Martin's Lane, near Covent Garden, the host venue for the book launch for Richard Moore's book, Etape. Is happening a little bit later on. A star-studded audience will be turning up here. Richard will be talking all about his book, not only at the event this evening, but also a little bit later on in the podcast.
Well, and a few listeners to the podcast are coming along who answered my plea last week for an audience. So thank you very much to all those who emailed and are coming tonight. But first of all, we're going to recap on the Giro, which finished at the weekend with Nairo Quintana winning. We are, as you say, Lionel, if you will indulge me, talk about my new book. And first of all, we're going to kick off with Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome, and Team Sky. We asked for questions yesterday, and a lot of the questions, a majority of the questions probably, were asking us to do a whole podcast on Froome, Wiggins, Team Sky, and whether Wiggins will go to the Tour de France.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So we're going to kick off talking about the Wiggins, Froome, Team Sky latest capers. We did ask for questions from listeners the other day, and we got a majority of questions probably were asking us to discuss Froome, Wiggins, Sky, what's going on. Sky, at the start of this week, announced their teams for the forthcoming Tour de France warm-up races, Tour of Switzerland and Critérium du Dauphiné. In the past couple of years, the Dauphiné has essentially been the team that's gone to the Tour plus one or two others. And so the assumption is made that since Chris Froome is going to the Dauphiné and Bradley Wiggins is going to the Tour of Switzerland, that they will not line up at the Tour de France together. And I think that's a fair assumption. I think that I would be very, very surprised now to see Wiggins ride the Tour de France. It's a long time since he and Froome have raced together. I also read Chris Froome's book over the weekend, which sheds a little bit more light on their relationship and why it is as bad as it is. And I don't think that... The question I always come back to is, does Chris Froome need Bradley Wiggins to win the Tour de France? Another question is, can Bradley Wiggins win the Tour de France? And I think the answer to the first question is no, and the answer to the second question is also no. But what do you think, Lionel? What did you read into those team selections?
Well, I think looking at the way Team Sky has prepared for the Tour de France the last number of years, they have pretty much picked the Tour team for the Critérium du Dauphiné and perhaps drafted in one or two people from the Tour de Suisse. So I think the ground is being prepared for Bradley Wiggins to be left out of the Tour team. I think more crucially is that obviously Froome and Wiggins don't really have a relationship, and the Tour de France is a pressure cooker. 3 weeks where they've all got to be pedalling in exactly the same direction. The fact that Froome and Wiggins, aside from the Olympic Games and the World Championships, have only raced together at the 2013 Tour of Oman, which Chris Froome won, and Wiggins finished in around about 50th place. They have no recent history of being teammates, and whether they can both be shoehorned into the same team, I think is questionable. However, my opinion on it has kind of swung from one direction to the next. I think if you were able to take the personalities out of it, which is obviously impossible, as a bike rider, Bradley Wiggins would be a phenomenal asset to that team because of the difficult stage in Yorkshire. You know, I think Wiggins would cope with that sort of Liège-Bastogne-Liège stage better than Chris Froome would, and of course the cobbles as well. And as I've said in the podcast we did with Ned Bolting a couple of weeks ago, if they were both in the Sky team, there's a strong possibility that Wiggins could be ahead on general classification before they get to La Planche des Belles Filles, which very much would kind of hamper Chris Froome in his ability to race all out, because he would have to be subservient to Bradley Wiggins, really, who would be ahead on the GC. So the problem of trying to manage those two people is, I think Dave Brailsford would want to avoid the possibility of, you know, it would be worse than 2012, wouldn't it? Because Froome is now an established Grand Tour champion as well. And as you say, of the two of them, he's probably got the better chance of actually winning the Tour de France. Daniel?
Just to introduce another element to this conversation, I know Dave Brailsford is a big advocate of the introduction of some kind of transfer system in cycling. Wouldn't it be fantastic if Bradley Wiggins was available for transfer just before? What a coup that would be for a team, because, you know, by rights he should be in Yorkshire. Some people were pointing out today on Twitter that he's the British rider with by far the biggest profile. It will be very strange and it will be a big call for Brailsford to leave him out. But, you know, unfortunately, that's not the case. I think there's been talk in the past about moves from one team to another before the Tour de France. I think Mario Cipollini once, when his team was snubbed for wild card, was in negotiations with another team to ride the Tour. It didn't happen. But, yeah, going back to your conversation earlier, I think, you know, the people that are advocating Wiggins' inclusion are going purely on theory and don't know the reality of...
And sentiment. Yeah, and that's infamously, that's not something that's going to influence Dave Brailsford's selection, is it?
No, but, you know, none of us know the full reality, but I think most of us are fairly clear about the fact that not only is there no relationship, I think there is a pretty bad, frosty relationship when they do come together. And like Rich says, I don't think Froome necessarily needs Wiggins. He would be an asset, but I think he could cause more harm than good to that team.
Just to throw in, I know some people out there don't like the football analogies, but people do kind of overlook the fact that cycling is a team sport. They're all have to ride to a plan. They have to ride to one objective. And if that objective is to win the Tour de France with Chris Froome, then Bradley Wiggins would have to fall very definitely into line and do pretty much as he's told every single day. And that requires not necessarily fetching bottles and rain jackets and doing the real donkey work, because he would slot into that line of Richie Port and Pete Kennock and the others in terms of when they take over and do some work. But if you take a football analogy, I think it's perhaps quite a British/English way of thinking of things, that all of your best people have to be in the team. Like when it comes to the England football team, the English could not countenance leaving out Wayne Rooney, whereas the Italians, the Spanish, the French, they do take more of a kind of holistic approach to looking at how teams are structured. And just because somebody is a very talented individual, if they don't serve the needs of the team, they will be happier, perhaps, to leave those stars out.
And I think just on Wiggins as well, it's a point I think we've made before, but if you look back at his career and his history as a rider, there has to be, whenever he's been in a domestic role, for him to perform effectively, there has to be some kind of emotional connection to the guy he's working with, some kind of friendship. You know, famously, the best ride he ever did as a domestique was for Mark Cavendish in the 2011 World Championships. And that was all about repaying a debt that he felt he had towards Cavendish after the 2008 Olympics, and, you know, just the friendship they'd built up over the years. But, you know, if there is no friendship, you know, we've seen Wiggins before, he's either fully engaged or he's completely disengaged. You know, even at the 2010 Tour de France, where he felt that he wasn't performing as well as he would have liked. You know, he unplugged from the situation and didn't do very well at all. And I can see that happening if, you know, he's not totally committed to the person he's riding for.
Yeah, and Daniel hints at it there. I don't think it's anything to do with structure, tactics. It's to do with personalities in this case. And I mentioned that I'd read Chris Froome's book. Very interesting. A little bit about them at the start of the Vuelta in 2011, where it was the race where Froome came to prominence. He was on his way out at Team Sky at that race. You know, his he was on a second year of a, well, he was in his final year of a €100,000 a year contract. He got the sense that Sky were wanting to renegotiate down to about €60,000 if he was going to be offered an extension at all. He prints all these text messages in the book that his agent, Alex Carrera, received from Dave Brailsford that just said, "What's Froome done? Nothing." And then during the Vuelta, he, of course, finished second. He beat Wiggins, who was third, and had started nominally leader. They shared a room at the start of that Vuelta. And the seeds for their bad relationship were really sown there in their shared bedrooms in Spain, where apparently Wiggins just completely blanked him. He wouldn't engage in conversation with him at all. He wouldn't make small talk. The extent of their exchanges was good night then. that was it. And Froome took that quite badly, and you know, particularly because he was on his uppers at the time, he was really in a bad way, and morale very low, very worried about his future, etc. And Wiggins, who was returning from broken collarbone at the Tour, was, you know, the team leader. He was in quite a good place, really, and Froome felt slighted by that and shared it with teammates. He eventually was moved into a different room because they thought he was carrying some kind of illness. So it was interesting to read that.
And again, about the emotional bond, the kind of friendship that might exist between a team leader and his domestique. You know, we all know that Chris Froome and Richie Porte are pretty much best friends. But even last year, in 2013, there were eyebrows raised in the Sky camp at certain times in the race about, for instance, Port riding so hard at Axe Trois Domaines to get to second place, about Port wanting to ride all out in the first time trial at Mont Saint-Michel. And you know, that is a guy, like I said, who shares his life with Froome, trains with him. And even he, you know, even for him, it was a massive, massive sacrifice to commit fully to Chris Froome. So if you're talking about a guy who's very, very ambivalent at best, hostile at worst to Froome, and then you want him to completely bury himself, you know, on every climb and completely forget about his own position, his own kind of, his own status, I just think it's unrealistic.
In terms of the Tour, we perhaps are a little guilty of thinking that it's only about Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins, but the point is, Chris Froome is probably the one that could beat Alberto Contador. Whether Bradley Wiggins could beat Alberto Contador firing on all cylinders is debatable. But in terms of the race and the start in Yorkshire, Richard, don't you think that the whole weekend is going to lose something? Because the British public, they've really taken Bradley Wiggins to their hearts. Chris Froome is still not really a household name here. It's much harder to interest even, you know, sort of national newspaper sports editors in anything about Chris Froome compared to Bradley Wiggins.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the race will lose something, won't it?
It will, absolutely. I mean, PR-wise, it's a bit of a disaster for Sky, I think. The home team, in inverted commas, starting on, you know, on home roads and starting without the iconic Bradley Wiggins. It's a massive dilemma for Dave Brailsford. You know, on the one hand, he has this star which would, you know, guarantee all the support, would certainly keep that home crowd happy. On the other hand, he's trying to win the Tour de France. And I suppose he will revert all the time to that question, what's the best chance we have of winning the Tour? He's not somebody who's going to go to the Tour with a plan A and a plan B. He's all about plan A. And I do also think that their attitude will be that Bradley Wiggins being on the team could hinder Froome. Could be, you know, this is famous in cycling. I'm not going to mention 1986, but I remember at the end of 2009, the Tour where Contador and Armstrong rode in the same team, and there was the same internal battle for leadership, and there was the same sour relationship between the two. At the end of it, Contador, a very strong character, quite like Froome in that sense, said, he was asked who had been his toughest opponent. He said, the hotel, that, you know, being back at the hotel. And for those of us who've not been in that situation, been on teams, been on buses, shared rooms with people, it's very hard, I think, to understand just how important it is to have good morale, to have a group of people who are, as Brailsford would say, aligning behind the same goal. You know, one or two bad apples really do, or one or two people that don't fit in or are in a bad way mentally or physically or whatever, they can sour the whole experience, the whole thing, and really diminish the effort. I mean, it's very interesting. Again, I chatted to David Walsh the other day, who's ghostwritten Chris Froome's book, and of course spent last year embedded with Team Sky and was on the race with the team last year. Now, the team wasn't as strong as it had been the previous year, and Froome, might have felt let down after the second day in the Pyrenees, where he was left on his own. Now, there were other factors at play there. They misjudged their own strength. They had some bad luck with Peter Kenyuk, etc. But according to Walsh, when Froome returned to the hotel that night, there was not an ounce of sort of anger or bitterness, or there were no recriminations. He was incredibly encouraging and grateful for what they had done for him. And he kind of put a positive spin even on Richie Porte chasing the group, which encouraged Movistar to work quite hard at the front of that group and eliminate him rather than really take on Froome. And, you know, that's interesting. And, you know, Walsh is a big admirer of Chris Froome, not just for his talent, but for his personality and those sorts of attributes. And I just don't think that Wiggins being there would... I think it'd be far harder to achieve that equilibrium, that harmonious atmosphere that you really do need.
Just on that point, actually, Richard, just two things occur there. You mentioned 2009 and the battle at Astana between Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong. That whole first week of the race, really, or certainly the first 4 or 5 days, was really a battle between the two of them to get ahead of the other, as I was saying at the start on GC, so that they were the top dog in their team. And that really led to Armstrong in the race in the crosswinds down on the south coast. I think they finished in Brignol. Mark Cavendish won the stage, but... Armstrong made that break and Contador was caught behind, and you know that was a real kind of intra-team battle between Armstrong and Contador, not just the fight between Mark Cavendish and his team trying to keep it away for the stage win. And just thinking about the atmosphere around Team Sky hotel and bus in 2012 when Bradley Wiggins was winning the race, I don't know if you were in Po the day they had their press conference outdoors in the blazing sunshine, and it was all delayed and it was all a bit shambolic. The riders were under canopies, but the media all sat out in the blazing sun. And they wheeled out Wiggins, Cavendish, Froome, maybe one or two other riders.
And the whole team.
The whole team, it was, wasn't it? That's right, yeah, and Dave Brailsford. And there was, as a study of body language, you didn't need to listen to what any of them were saying, but as a study of body language, there were some not terribly happy campers in, sat at the top table there. And Chris Froome, second on GC, and I don't think was asked a question, which was quite extraordinary. Compare that to 2013, where, as you say, Richard, Sky were weaker. They did show vulnerability in the mountains particularly, but the team bus was a much more approachable place. It was a much happier place to be. And whether you can attribute that to Bradley Wiggins' absence or not, we can debate. But certainly they had united, whether they were feeling strong or whether they were feeling weak, they'd united behind Chris Froome.
Just the last thing on this, I'm going to whimsically return to this idea of this improbable scenario of Wiggins changing teams before the tour. There is a precedent, I've just remembered, and I should remember because late in 2001 I was working for the Mappe company in Italy, and they of course sponsored the biggest team in the world at the time. And one afternoon, I think late in September, the boss of the company, Giorgio Squinzi, called a few journalists, and I also went into a boardroom, and he said, "I'm sick of Michele Bartoli. I'm even more sick of his wife, who's his agent. And I've brought you here today to announce that we've broken the contract with him. He's going to sign for Fassa Bortolo and he's going to ride the last couple of races of the season for Fassa Bortolo," which actually happened. And I'm not sure whether under current UCI regulations...
Well, it happened last year with Pataki. Pataki started the season with Lamprey. That's and true. Retired. That's and true. then was racing... the end of the season for Omega Pharma, wasn't he?
That's very true, yep.
So they would have to break his contract. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Wiggins has a plan B, and I think that's to ride the Commonwealth Games. I think we'll see Bradley not just riding the time trial, as he's always said, but also riding the track events at the Commonwealth Games, and they will have a huge profile in the UK, and he'll probably get as much attention in Britain for winning a gold medal in the Commonwealth Games as he would get for finishing on the podium of the tour, certainly.
So, let's not sit on the fence. Daniel, will Team Sky select Bradley Wiggins for the tour?
No.
Richard, same question?
Absolutely, 100% not.
Well...
Hang on. First stage of the Dauphiné. Okay. Chris Froome.
Okay, not 100%. Okay, 90%. Yeah, I mean... If Froome can't go, then Wiggins will go. If something happens to Froome, then Wiggins will go. Another rumor. I'm not going to go all guns ablaze. I have this habit of really sort of exaggerating any little bits of gossip out here. I did announce that Edvald Boasenhagen is joining BMC, which I understand is going to happen, but that unleashed a storm of... I got some calls the next day from Norwegian media. I now know to look for that code. But I understand that Geraint Thomas will be leaving Sky at the end of this year, that they're not prepared to meet his wage demands and that he is on the move. I don't know where, but I, I don't think he'll be at Team Sky after this season.
Well, you heard it here first.
You like it? I might retract it a bit. 90% Geraint Thomas. 90% Geraint Thomas won't be at Sky next year.
I've got a bit of transfer speculation as well. So, Fabio Aru, the revelation of the Giro d'Italia, finished on the podium. 23, has a contract with Astana next year, 2015. There were some mysterious reports surfaced about Sky maybe being interested in and BMC taking him away from Astana. And I spoke to his agent today and asked him whether there's anything in this, and he said he's got a contract next year. There are no negotiations open with anyone. To which I replied, "Well, that's a very enigmatic response," and he said, "No comment."
Even more enigmatic. Lionel, we've not got around to you. Do you think Bradley Wiggins will go to the Tour?
I think unless something happens to Froome in the Dauphiné, no. But if Bradley Wiggins were to win the Tour of Switzerland, I mean, that would really put the cat among the pigeons, wouldn't it?
It would, but I don't think he will. Do you?
No, I don't, but he could be sort of, if he's got his head on and he wants to prove a point to the world that he should go to the Tour de France, what better way than, you know, giving it absolutely everything? You know, the course will probably not be hostile for him. It will probably suit him as well as races he's won in the past, the Dauphiné, Paris-Nice. You know, it's not going to be, you know, if you can win the Tour de France, you can win the Tour of Switzerland. And if he really feels like he wants to make a real pain of himself, he could do that.
I'm going down to 80% now, maybe 75.
Well, there's plenty to talk about. Daniel has nicely set up part two of the podcast, in which we will discuss the Giro d'Italia.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
The Giro d'Italia finished on Sunday, and it was won by Nairo Quintana, the Colombian, who rode a perfectly judged race, I thought. I think he was a comfortable winner in the end. He started as a favourite. He got it just right. Like the Tour last year, he seemed to get stronger as the race went on. He was never really in trouble. But I thought it was a notable race for the emergence of some young stars. Very young. I calculate the top seven. The average age of the top seven was 25 and a half.
Four of them were under 25, I think.
Yeah, three 24-year-olds and a 23-year-old, I think. Fabio Aru. Pierre Roland is still a young rider. I thought Pierre Roland was added an awful lot to the Giro, rode a very aggressive race, very impressive race. And Rigoberto Urán was second year in a row. He's 27. And Fabio Aru, the revelation of the race, really was third. So quite an enjoyable race. Didn't really burst into life. I thought, you know, Quintana was such a measured performance over the 3 weeks, perfectly judged race, and I think he's like a kind of miniature Miguel Indurain, isn't he? Not perhaps with his time trialing ability, but that impassive expression, he doesn't give anything away, he's so smooth, it looks easy. And I think there's I think people quite like seeing real class acts like that do their thing. But whether he, you know, there was sort of, people love also the types like Aru, who it's far more expressive, far more explosive, and obviously an exciting climber. Daniel, what were your thoughts on the Giro?
I mean, I looked at the route, and especially sort of a week from the end, as the race had turned out, I looked at the mountain stages to come and thought this is going to be too much.
Dolomites.
And there was one stage that flirted with the Dolomites, I was concerned that the last stage of the Zonkerland would be very, very turgid indeed, because it had just been too hard, too much climbing. And that was true to an extent. The Zonkerland itself, it's one of those mountains that has a very kind of distinct visual identity, which plays in its favour. I think, everyone sort of recognises the kind of narrow road now, and the narrow tree-lined road, and the sort of natural amphitheatre at the top, and it certainly, I think, merits inclusion in the Giro for that reason. You know, it's one of those iconic climbs already, after only really a decade of appearing in the race. But in terms of skeptical spectacle, it does flatter to deceive. The time gaps are fairly meagre. Riders tend to yo-yo back and forth in between groups, and there are no major moves. And I mean, it has a certain fascination all of its own, but it's certainly not as spectacular. You know, if you look at the climb to Europa, which was Very spectacular, and these days we tend to see the most sort of attacking, interesting racing in the mountains on the less sort of prohibitive gradients. I mean, Rich, I said this to you the other day about the Verbier stage in 2009 Tour de France. There were some sort of really striking and fast attacks, and on the Angliru, the Zonkerland, it's a different style of racing.
Yeah, I thought after saying last week that the joy of the Giro was that it was bubbling up into a real kind of battle between several very closely matched riders, and also with the absence of a really strong team. Actually, in the final week, Movistar judged it perfectly. They were incredibly strong. There were so many of them at the front. It must have been almost, Rigoberto Urán, Fabio Aru to an extent. They must have known that really their chances were severely limited by the fact that Movistar still had a whole team on the front coming to the final mountains. They were as impressive in this Giro as Sky were in 2012 in the Tour, really. They were by far the best team in the mountains, and Quintana was the best climber. He completely put the seal on his victory and kind of wiped the controversy of the Stelvio away in the time trial. And in a way, that was a saving grace, because I think had the race come down to handfuls of seconds between Urán and Quintana, we would still be talking about the move where was the race neutralised or wasn't it, where Quintana and Roland and a couple of others got away and gained all that time. With a week to go, and the other thing that kind of soured the Zonkerland stage for me anyway was that the spectators don't quite get that all of the running alongside, and I mean the running alongside is off-putting. You kind of feel quite tense watching it because you don't want to see somebody stumble and fall into the riders. But the spectator in the World Champions jersey who pushed Francesco Bongiorno, who was away with Michael Rogers 3 kilometres from the top. Rogers looks the strongest. He looked totally in control. He looked like the likely winner. But Bongiorno, he was there. He had a chance. A young rider, I think only his second Giro. And the spectator gave him a helping hand, a push that was well-meaning but totally ill-advised. Bongiorno went into the back of Mick Rogers, had to take his foot out of the pedal. His momentum was completely lost, and then, that was his chance of winning the stage gone. And, it's difficult. People have asked us on Twitter what can be done to prevent this kind of thing happening. Very little you can do other than say, let's barrier the last 5 or 10K of a climb, which would be not only impractical but completely change the character of the race.
I wonder if that though will act as a sort of warning to other people. We see what can happen, especially on a really steep climb like that, where it doesn't take much for somebody to lose their balance really and lose their momentum. So I wonder if that will, but having said that, I think when the next group came up, our friend in the World Champions jersey, I don't think it was Rui Costa.
No.
I did say, we talk about the curse of the rainbow jersey. This was, gave that a whole new meaning. But he was at it again, he was pushing more people, so he wasn't deterred. And it's difficult. It's just a case of hoping that people will not behave like complete idiots.
And I think when you've been watching bike racing for years and years, you become very blasé about, the fifth guy in Mankini running alongside the rider at the front of the race, and you barely even notice it. But I think you have to remember that for the new viewer who tunes into the stage on Saturday, that is one of the most appealing things about mountain stages in major tours, that it is just balmy. It's completely balmy that these guys, that people are turning up dressed in tutus, and they are running alongside the riders, and they are getting shoved out of the way and having their sunglasses stolen. And in a way, it is part of the circus, and
Fantastic. Who was that again? One rider managed to very deftly pick a spectator's sunglasses from his head as he ran alongside. That was wonderful. Again, it could act as a warning, or even just a warning not to wear expensive sunglasses, I suppose.
It would be the equivalent, and again, unfortunately, it's going to be a football reference here. Oh. But, people talk about the difference in atmosphere since standing has been taken away from football grounds in most countries and replaced by seating. And, there is a noticeable difference. And if we were going to say, okay, I mean, A, it's impractical to bury the whole climb, but if that was to happen, I think the atmosphere would really suffer quite badly.
Now, we asked a few people for some questions. The majority were about Wiggins and Froome and Skye. But we had a very interesting one from John Montgomery, who emailed us to say that as a new cycling fan, it's incredibly frustrating to see the major events without all the major competitors. He says he loves seeing Wiggins dominate in California and Quintana in Italy. But without Froome or Contador in either event, he thinks it diminishes not only those races, but also the Tour de France, because, of course, Quintana is not going to ride. Last year's runner-up, now Giro champion, he won't be there to challenge Froome and Contador. He says, can you guys explain the logic? It seems unimaginable that some teams intend for their best riders to miss the marquee events of the season. I know you've touched on the UCI scheduling before, but why don't the riders put their feet down and demand a schedule that allows all the big names to compete in at least one big tour?
Yeah, I can totally see that argument. There's something just quirky, anachronistic about the cycling calendar, which part of me quite likes. I mean, I'll use a tennis analogy. In tennis, the top four players play each other all the time, and it gets boring, I think. I'm not sure that it would be all that. I mean, such are the rhythms of a season in cycling that you tend to get riders trying to peak for one event, and this year is kind of exceptional with Quintana prioritising the Giro. It's quite unusual, though we forget just what a young developing rider he is, and I think this is part of a longer term plan. Generally speaking, we do see the best riders at the Tour, so that this is an unusual year, but generally speaking, we do see the best riders at the Tour, and we always see the best One Day Classics riders in all the One Day Classics. So I can totally see the argument. I think, though, that to use the Quintana example this year is slightly misleading, because I think that's quite unusual.
And I think that, if all the riders, if all the best riders invariably every single year rode the Tour and not the Giro and the Vuelta, ultimately the Giro and the Vuelta would probably disappear eventually, or an awful lot of races would disappear, because they rely on certain big names, not all the big names being there. And that was the Giro in the past has paid appearance money. It was a bit of a moot point as to whether that had happened this year with Quintana, but they certainly go to great lengths to ensure that there are at least one or two riders, because they desperately need them from an economic point of view.
Yeah, I certainly think the point that John makes in his email about the Tour California, that's a slight red herring, because it's not a grand tour. It has a high profile because it's the biggest event in America. It's televised in the UK on Eurosport. And I think that television, in an odd way, we are so spoiled now with the amount of coverage. I mean, you can watch the whole of the Tour of Turkey if you want. And there isn't a great deal of signposting in terms of, other than the Tour de France and the Giro, where do the rest of these events kind of fit in? And the riders that choose to ride these particular events almost define their importance by turning up. So Mark Cavendish rode at the Tour of Turkey this year, which gives it a cachet that in previous years it hasn't had. And that happens with other races as well. But I think, in terms of having all the best riders at the Tour, I agree with you, Rich. We've seen Vincenzo Nibali develop as a rider. He had a go at the Tour and finished, well up there on third place, wasn't he, in 2012, and then takes a step back and goes and proves that he can win the Giro and ticks that one off, and now comes back to the Tour in 2012, if not physically stronger, then certainly mentally stronger. And I think, it's a bit like, probably the closest analogy is boxing, where you have a number of...
All the sports today, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
Not golf yet, although we did have... The question was from a John Montgomery. I was kind of hoping it was going to be Colin.
But. John Montgomery, not Colin Montgomery. But the point about boxing is that there's a rhythm to the boxing scene where, the contenders compete amongst each other for a shot at the world title. And then these big fights that happen between two big names are actually quite rare events. So maybe in 2015, the Tour de France, we will see Quintana line up against Froome, against Nibali, and, whoever else has emerged this year.
I mean, one thing that a race like the Giro still has incredible standing and status, and it's great to see the Giro really has made a star of Fabio Aru, who very few people had heard of a few weeks ago. So I don't think his performance there was judged by the riders he was riding against. It was more that he had performed like that at the Giro in a Grand Tour, and I think those races still do have that that gift of making stars of emerging young riders.
I mean, it's also like another sport, podcasting. You know, you can't have, in the sport of podcasting, you can't have all the big hitters in the ring at the same time. You can't have a Ciro Scognamiglio and an Owen Slott and a Richard Moore every week. You know, it would be too much of a good thing.
That's true. And on that note, Daniel, I believe you're setting up a very exciting special podcast at the Tour de France with Ciro and Pipo Pozzato. We're going to get them both on together.
Talks are underway.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at @cycling_podcast.
So in the final segment, Richard, the stage is set. It's all yours. We're going to talk about your new book, your latest oeuvre, Étape, which is the story of you riding the Étape du Tour in 2013. Is it not? No, have I misunderstood?
No, Daniel, you haven't. You have misunderstood. Yeah, that's not correct. It's 20 chapters, 20 stages of the tour. In fact, one chapter includes three stages, but then another chapter includes a rest day and another chapter includes a prologue. So it does actually come to 20 stages. It's kind of a modern tour. The earliest stage is 1971, most recent 2012. It was difficult to work out how I should describe what these stages are. They're not the greatest. The most interesting, there's a mixture of great ones. There's some appalling ones, some that were ruined by scandal and so on. So it's a real kind of mixed bag. I thought it could be quite formulaic, telling the same kind of story every chapter, how somebody won a stage. So there's crashes, there's drugs, there's a death in one, and so on. But the key to it really was to go out and interview the protagonist or protagonists from each stage, and that was essential to it and the most enjoyable part of it.
Some very interesting encounters in there. One that certainly stood out for me was your trip to see Claudio Chiappucci near his home, or at his home near Lake Como. Claudio Chiappucci, of course, the winner of the famous Stade de Sestriere in 1992, Tour de France, which is the subject of your chapter. Tell us a bit, Rich, about going to meet El Diablo.
Well, it was one of these things, and you've probably had the same experience, both of you, where you set up an interview with somebody and it's all arranged for the day, and then it comes the day itself or the day before and you can't get hold of them anymore. They go missing and you've travelled to Italy and it all seems to be off, and panic stations. But I was with Gregor Brown, our friend and colleague who was translating for me. He's an Italian speaker. And we arrived and there was no sign of El Diablo. He lives in a three-story house with three buzzers, all of them which say Chiappucci beside them. So it's very much the family home.
That reminds me actually of a quote from the chapter itself when he talked about how strong he felt on the climb to Sestriere, and he said, "I was like one Chiappucci, no, two Chiappuccis. No, I was a cooperative of Chiappuccis."
Yeah, absolutely. There were lots of very good quotes he came out with, but first of all, he wasn't there. His brother appeared on the balcony of the first floor and said he didn't know where he was, and said he actually never knows where he is, but he was sure he'd be back soon. And lo and behold, he did appear in a sort of people carrier, looking about 25, with a 25-year-old girlfriend from Lille. He's 50 now. And he was very, he bounded out. He was wearing fashionable jeans and a sort of big white chunky watch and a tight black shirt, black glossy mane. Took us up to the third floor, introduced us to Mama Chiappucci, who was wrapped in an apron, this kind of old woman, who was very welcoming, showed us into basically what was a shrine to Claudio. Pictures everywhere of him meeting the Pope, winning races, the devil-shaped phone in the corner, cushions on the sofa adorned with Claudio's face, his image. It was very Italian. It was very entertaining. Then Chiappucci disappeared again for ages, and then eventually he came back and he sat down on his own face on the cushion, and he began to tell us his story, and also obviously the story of that day to Sestriere, which for those of us who watched the Tour in the 90s, probably one of the most famous stages of all time. He was on his own almost for 200 kilometres, basically, over several mountain passes, and held off the great injury, and who cracked in the final few kilometres, which he'd never seen before or since. In fact, Indurain's teammate Jean-Francois Bernard said it was the only time he ever saw him struggle to get up the stairs in the hotel. He was so exhausted, and And Claudio, well, I mean, how did he do it? Who knows? But let's just say that Claudio was part of a sort of emerging generation of Italian riders who, you know, he was quite a late developer. He was 27 in 1990 when he took the yellow jersey and held it for most of that, or a lot of that tour. But yeah, you know, climber, charismatic. It was all about panache, you know, injury was robotic. Claudio was sort of an irritant, really, but hugely entertaining for the fans.
There's a great variety of stories in there that kind of cover the whole realm of riders' experience in the tour. Was there anything, you know, when you'd finished the book, when you'd written all sort of 21 chapters, did you have almost a keener appreciation of that? You know, how many different ingredients go into the Tour de France and into riders' experiences in the Tour?
Well, it's really interesting to sit a rider down and ask him, you're not just asking about one stage, but that's the main subject. It's a very interesting kind of window into their careers, into how they felt on that particular day. And it's a sort of, it's often a stage is a tour in microcosm and a rider's career in microcosm. You know, one of the most satisfying interviews in a way was Bobby Julich talking about Les Deux Alpes in 1998, a very famous stage won by Marco Pantani. And, you know, Julich didn't win. He thought he was riding into the yellow jersey that day, not realising that Pantani took 5 minutes out of him on the final climb. And then just his perspective on that stage, on the terrible weather, and little things, you know, it's little details that really make these stories, I think, interesting. It wasn't actually Julich, but Jorgi Aksch, who I also interviewed for that chapter, spoke about the food that they use. He was riding for Pulte. He was German riding for Pulte, an Italian team. And Jan Ulrich cracked that day, a German riding for a German team. And he really blew up. He didn't dress properly, didn't eat properly. He cracked hugely and lost the tour effectively that day. And Jaksch said that he reckoned a factor in that was that Julich was eating, you know, power bars, and Pantani was eating little bread rolls that with you know, butter and jam. Very old school, and the power bars in that sort of weather became just too cold to eat, so Julich couldn't eat it properly. And it's those kind of details. There are loads of them like them. I mean, another chapter I really enjoyed doing was Joel Pellier's solo win in 1989, the longest solo escape since 1947, I think. And Thierry Marie went a bit further a couple of years later, but you know, just little details. His mother and father had made a special journey to watch him that day. It was the only time they ever saw him race, because they had to look after his disabled brother, who needed 24-hour care. And everybody saw the images at the end of him greeting his family, and there were tears, and it was very emotional. What nobody really knew was that he didn't know they were going to be there. It was a total coincidence. And so, you know, the emotions at the end were surprise as much as joy. And that was, there was so much to that story. There always is. I mean, that's what was so enjoyable about it, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, what I'm really looking forward to, I've not actually seen the book yet, Richard. Mine's probably in the post, is it?
I was going to get it, Lionel. Go on in my bag. No.
I'll wait until Richard passes one over. What I really like about the idea is, I mean, you know, when I've worked for the magazines, we've kind of done these kind of things where you go back and look at a particular race and talk to the protagonists as you've done here. I think to put it in book form, you know, it's really important, because there is a sense I've felt certainly in that the tour history is kind of almost set and frozen, and almost like there's a sort of a glass ceiling of around about 1985, 86, where prior to that we're so familiar with all the same stories. Not to take anything away from them, but they are stories that have been written firstly in French books, translated by French-speaking English writers, and kind of passed down and handed down, and the kind of myth that grows around some of these stories. What is really refreshing is to go and look at some of the more recent tours and actually add to the tour history. You know, it may be that some of these stories have already been written in France or in other countries, but to kind of take the English language tour history on to another step, because every year we see lots of tour history books come out, and they kind of give the same tour history, And it would be nice over the, you know, the next sort of generation, particularly as we're experiencing this big boom in cycling writing in the UK and in America, to uncover some stories from the more recent past and actually sort of shed a different light on and uncover some stories that aren't so familiar. Is that one of the motivations? Is that what you set out to kind of do?
Yeah, kind of. I think what is most enjoyable about it in a way and satisfying is that at the tour itself, when you're there, riders will tell you so much. But the longer you go away from the event, the more they actually tell you, the more they tend to open up, because there isn't so much at stake. They're not worried anymore about upsetting a rival or a teammate or whoever. You know, I spoke to Mark Cavendish about the stage he won in Obanas in 2009, and that morning he'd stood up on the bus and said, "Guys, I can win the stage today." Bjarne Riis had told him that he thought he could get over the climb at the finish and win. He stood up and said, "I can win this. I need you to support me. I need you to believe in me." And Kim Kirchen, a teammate, got in the break that day, and because he didn't basically, he obviously didn't have faith in that Cavendish would get over that climb. And, you know, at the time, Cavendish would not have pointed the finger at Kirchen for doing that. So you go back years later and you get a much richer, much more detailed history, a different one. And you know, Stephen Roach talking about Jean-François Bernard in 1987. You haven't mentioned Lance Armstrong. I interviewed Lance Armstrong for this book as well, talking about Limoges in 95 and Luz Ardiden in 2003. I mean, there's the most obvious example of somebody who can tell you a different version of that story now, because we know that he was doping. So you can ask him about it, and he's quite vague, but he will at least open up a little bit about, you know, he told me what his hematocrit was on the eve of the 2003 tour when he was below par and he was worried, you know. And I said, "Well, clearly you boosted that at some point, didn't you?" And, you know, he can't exactly say no. So it's very interesting, and it just, as you say, adds to the layers of knowledge, understanding we have. It's just enjoyable as well. A lot of riders quite enjoy talking about old stages, especially ones that they've won. I mean, one of the most poignant examples of that in a way was Andy Schleck talking about his win at the Galibier in 2011. I interviewed him about that sort of 18 months after the event, and he was talking about it as though he was a retired rider, as though it was in the past. And
he is, isn't he?
Well, he's still riding, but there was a sense, a very strong sense, that he kind of didn't expect to be at that level again, which was quite surprising for a rider who's still young.
So, Richard, the book is called Etap. It's published by HarperCollins, and it's priced
£20.
Be available for a lot cheaper on Amazon.
20 new English pounds. Thank you very much for indulging me, fellas. It's really kind.
I'm not sure I'll be indulging you with £20.
I'm gonna pay for this later. But thanks for us, and thank you to Browns, who are hosting my book launch this evening in this beautiful judge's court. I think a great venue, very grand, and I'm very grateful to them for their support of my book launch. So thanks very much for listening to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And we'll speak to you again next week.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.